Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacey Toth of PaleoParents.com. You might also know me as the broth lady, or the inventor of the hashtag More Vegetables Than a Vegetarian. I'm the co-author of several paleo cookbooks, including Eat Like a Dinosaur, Beyond Bacon, Real Life Paleo. I like to talk about health at any size, and self-love, and personal acceptance. Specifically, I have a love for lifting heavy things. If you're interested in finding more out about that, you can also find me on Strong Woman Radio.
And I'm Dr. Sarah Valentine for PaleoMom.com. I'm the New York Times best-selling author of The Paleo Approach and The Paleo Approach Cookbook. I'm passionate about nutrient density and the intersection of diet and lifestyle with health, which really means I just love talking about science.
News and Peace, where Sarah and I catch up, and you get to listen to our gossip. Sarah, do you know what's happened while you've been gone?
No. Wait, what? Something happened? Was there like an earthquake?
I've become obsessed with Tove Lo, who's a singer who has serious mental problems. And I'm just telling our listeners, if you, like me, because I know Sarah is not yet up on this popular culture, have listened to this music, are we all disturbed? Should we be calling an intervention for this poor girl, who, by the way, is like 27? Super disturbed. You need to Google it. The lyrics to her music is so disturbing. That's all I have to say.
And so you're listening to it because you relate to it?
I just really like it. I don't know why, but as I'm listening to it, it's like a train
wreck.
Do
you like it despite the lyrics?
Yeah. Okay. Also, kind of, it's
kind of
funny.
Like if you listen to Radiohead lyrics carefully and then you realize what they're talking about? Kind of like that level?
No, it's kind of like the super emo, like, teenage music that you used to listen to. Like, I don't know how old people are and what
never,
they listen to.
I was never a teenager, but...
Right. So, I mean, like, in my days, I listened to this woman named Bonnie McKee, who's actually a famous songwriter now, and her original album that I was obsessed with is about, like, being 17. Like, the struggles of being 17. And I also was obsessed with Tori Amos and, like, that kind of music. And so I think...
Wow, you're so much younger than me.
I know.
I know. Like, wow.
So my point is that I feel like maybe I'm reliving my youth through this woman. Although she's like, I said, 27. She's not a kid, but she makes me feel like she's a kid.
So here's the funny thing. Like, 27 to you is like close to your age. And 27 to me is like a lot younger than me. And there's kind of a different, we're in different places. That's all I'm saying. And it's fine. It's fine. I don't judge you based on your youngness. I hope you don't judge me based on my oldness.
I do.
Okay. That's sad.
That's okay, Grandma.
Okay, so you're obsessed with super disturbing music.
That's like pretty much all that's happened in America while you've been gone.
Wow.
There was some soccer thing. And, there was
World Women's winning the World Cup thing?
I mean, something like that.
Something random, okay. Yeah.
So I'm just going to put out there. I read this really cool. Evidently, News and Views is actually about news this week. So I read this article about how despite the women actually winning the cup, their salaries are lower than the men's soccer team. And it's like going around as like the big women pay gap example situation. Just putting that out there. And then this other thing happened while we're talking about sports. The ESPN Body Magazine came out.
Okay, so I'm not completely out of loop because I saw that.
They have the internet in Canada? I'm still feeling that stare all the way from the west coast of Canada.
This is why it's really good that we don't do a video podcast. Because you would have been like, lasered to death right there.
You didn't like my joke?
I just spent the whole day on the beach, so just saying.
I worked, and then I worked out, and now I'm podcasting.
I beached. I went out for coffee.
I'm a little bit
jealous. I beached some more. Just saying.
All right, so you read this article. Are you inspired? Isn't it awesome?
I love muscular bodies. Like, to me, that is what. But that sounded so lewd. I didn't mean to sound that lewd. I just, that to me is what I want. I don't want to be thin. I want to be strong. I want to be able to see my muscles. Like, that's, for me, that's my goal. And to have these amazingly beautiful women athletes featured as these beautiful bodies, and then to really highlight the different way elite athletes' bodies look, right? So that, you know, a volleyball player looks different from an archer, looks different from a hammer thrower, and they're all the top athletes in their sports, and they're all amazingly beautiful, and the body shapes are different, right? Because they're suited for this amazing sport, then these sports are so different. And there was just, and then there was just nothing about it that wasn't amazing. It was just, it was such a great way to celebrate health and also be really grounded in terms of body image. And it was a really, I think, amazing combination. And when I saw it, I thought of you.
Oh, I'm so touched that you thought of me. Several people sent me that article and said that they thought of me. And I was like, I must be doing something right because this article is freaking amazing. And if this makes people think of me, I just like am pulling the wool over people's eyes. yeah, no, I totally loved it too. And not just did I like the women body empowerment and the athletic approach and all that kind of stuff that you talked about, but I loved that ESPN, which is historically like this man channel, is the source of the content. Like, that to me is really super awesome too, that this is like a broad reaching thing. And I'm hopeful that it reaches people who, unlike you and me, where we're kind of preaching to the choir, that other people might see or learn something new. And I remember there was like similar type stuff several years ago with the Williams sisters and the way that their bodies were built, and they were so good in tennis and they look different than other people in tennis. And so I think it's interesting kind of the turn that hopefully media is taking in terms of the way that they see athletes and view health and that whole metric of health and body acceptance that we've talked about for a long time. And one of the lines that Matt and I really liked in the article was by the hammer thrower, who reminds me a lot of myself. And she was saying that she just thinks that people should do what their bodies are best at. Just embrace it. Like, your body is your body. Don't wish for something different. You know, if you're a thick, muscular girl who's good at weightlifting, like, it's not going to be productive for you to wish that you were super skinny and could run marathons, and vice versa. Like, you know, there are things that she can do that people with a different build can't. And it, you know, reminded me of an article that Matt wrote a long time ago when I started Strongman about me saying I want to be strong because I had been training for a 5K and I wasn't getting any better no matter how long I worked at it. And yeah, so I totally agree. And I think that inspired by this article, we should do a show on like exercise.
We actually have recently had quite a lot of exercise related question. So I think that fits really, really well, because I think that I actually think it's been a while since we've really talked about this activity aspect of a paleo lifestyle, which I see as being really critical for health. And it's not just, right, it's not just doing CrossFit, which is so stereotypical, or going to the gym, right? Like, when we talk about increasing activity in our lives in order to achieve health, you know, in many ways, what ends up happening is people do their sedentary day and then work out really, really hard, and then they're completely sedentary. And what the studies really show is that the best impacts on health come from low and moderate levels of movement throughout the day, interspersed with the occasional intense movement. And it's those intense movements, whether that's something like sprinting or something that tends to not cause as much stress to the body, but also builds these wonderful type 2 muscle fibers, something like heavy weightlifting. Those things, they change the types of muscle that we have in our body. They're amazing hormone signals, amazing, you know, structural signals to how our bones are constantly remodeling. And so that's sort of like the ideal in terms of health, is figuring out how to have a low level of activity throughout the day, sort of interspersed with something that is more intense.
I think that's, yeah. I mean, I know you have a Fitbit. I got an Apple Watch and I was hoping that it would like give me those reminders every hour, like stand
up. You're the first person I know with an Apple Watch.
I returned it. Anyway, that's a different story. It didn't have the fitness functionality that I was looking for. And it didn't, because you had to charge the battery every day, you couldn't like wear it for sleep performance either. So I'm hoping that the next version is a little bit better for what I wanted it for. But my point is that I've been trying to find ways to remind myself to get up, because I work in my own office space. So I, you know, go and I get my coffee and my water and I sit at my desk and I'm good for a really long time until I need to go to the bathroom. And sometimes I don't even need to, like, I don't realize that I need to do that until way late in the afternoon. And I have my own printer at my desk and I have, like, there's, you know, nothing that causes me to get up. But I started a new job a couple of weeks ago, and I've been intentionally like building into my routine, doing different things to get up and walk every hour and go up and down the stairs or do something just a couple of times a day, I think makes a big difference in my general mobility. Like, I notice that if I sit all day long and then try to train that muscle fiber that you're talking about, like, it's less engaged and ready to do what I want it to do because it's like in sleep mode, you know? So I think that makes sense for me on a practical level from what you're saying the science supports. So I'm just basically like N=1. Yep.
Yeah. Check the box. I think we've got N=2 here. So it's one of the things that always, so I work at a treadmill desk at home, and depending on the day, sometimes I don't get on it at all. Right. Sometimes if I'm, you know, running around doing errands, or if it's a really kid centered day, or sometimes I'm really tired and I choose to move my computer to a table and sit at a table. And then I have other days where I walk like 6 hours, but I typically average 10 to 12,000 steps a day. And I'm traveling now, visiting family in Canada. And so I don't have access to a treadmill desk. And we're doing a lot of things that are like amazing, right? But it's like, go sit at the beach, swim for 5 seconds because the Pacific Ocean's really cold, and then sit at the beach some more. And it's very relaxing, but it's not active the way my body's used to being active. And I woke up 2 mornings ago sore, and sore as though I had used my muscles. And I realized that it was from disuse rather than from, you know, I hadn't done anything unusual. And so that was like, okay, I now need to figure out how to go for a walk in the evening or do something so that I can, you know, use my muscles for the next 2 weeks, and then I'll be back home and back in my environment. But it's always when there's a shift. So, you know, when my treadmill broke and I had to wait 2 weeks for a new treadmill, right? That was like, oh man, I didn't realize, you know, most days it might only be an hour or two working at this treadmill desk, and yet I really notice when I don't get that time. And so it's, I think, a really common experience for those of us who've figured out how to troubleshoot those low levels of activity into our day, whether it's something like a treadmill desk where you can get these little, like, totally not motorized, they're like little bike pedals that fit under a sitting desk, and they're like $150, which I realize is a lot of money for some people. But when you think about how you can keep your blood flow going, you can keep your leg muscles moving, but it's something that can fit into a lot more business environments much, much more easily than a treadmill desk. And treadmill desks are much more expensive investments. You know, there's things like that, or there's just the simple, right, exactly what you're doing, trying to figure out how to alter the routine so you're getting up every 30 minutes or an hour. And you can, there's a bunch of different apps that can set alarms on your computer, set alarms on your phone, right? There's ways that you can remind yourself to get up and move. And for those of us who've figured out how to incorporate that into our lives and get away from that sitting for an hour in traffic each way for our commute, and then sitting for 8 hours during the day with maybe like the occasional, you know, get up to get some lunch in the middle of the day. When we lose that, like, it's, oh my gosh, I didn't realize how much better I feel with, you know, what's really nominal movement, right? Like when you work at a treadmill desk, you're walking slowly. You're not going for a walk. It's just enough to keep moving. It's not, right? Most people walk between 1 and 2 miles an hour. It's very slow. But it's not sitting, right? So that's something that I feel really passionately about, trying to increase awareness about the different options there are for incorporating more movement into our day. While also, you know, I really like to support companies that I see creating these great solutions. Like, to me, that's something that's really important. And it's a way that we can, I think it's a biohack, right? So it's a way that we can get this amazing thing that's super healthy for us without giving up comforts, right? Without giving up our great paying jobs that allow us to do all these other things, like pay the bills, or other things. But I see that as being something that we need to incorporate more into the paleo movement, which is this, not just these more elite, you know, athletic programs like CrossFit or, you know, Strongman or, you know, triathlons or whatever it is. I see the need for us to start talking more about how to increase that gentle motion throughout the day.
I'm just over here going whoop whoop.
I thought you were maybe talking away and muted again, because, you know,
sometimes that happens. I was muted, but no, I was just doing like end zone dance, like you're bringing it home.
That's active.
So I did work out earlier, so this is about as active as I'm gonna get. I'm like in wind down mode right now.
I am sitting in a chair, which. Something I've been doing a lot of today, but I get to go for a walk when we're done. So that probably means we should move on to something like sciencey or questiony or something.
I'm down with the science.
Next segment is Science with Sarah, where I take a moment to explain the details and the whys.
One of the things that I've talked about on the podcast before when we've talked about exercise is the need for avoiding really intense exercise. And unfortunately, what is too intense is really individual. So it's hard to say, like, you can run 10 miles, but don't run 12, right? I can't put a number on it. Or you can run it 5 miles an hour, but not 7 miles an hour. There's no way that I can put a number on it because it varies from individual to individual. But there's a collection of scientific studies showing that intense activity causes a leaky gut. And we can refer back to where I've talked about that on old podcasts, or you can refer to where I discuss that in detail in the paleo approach. But I wanted to today, because we're talking a little bit more about some of the practical aspects of increasing activity and, you know, being more athletic in our lives, I want to talk about strategies for mitigating a leaky gut when we are doing what is more intense activity for us. So rather than doing, we don't really need to worry about effects on our gut health when we're doing something really gentle, but when we do go to do that short burst of more intense activity, how do we protect our bodies? And the approach to how to eat and hydrate around that activity to maintain the gut barrier is a different approach than performance approaches. So you'll see a lot of recommendations of, you know, pre-workout smoothies, post-workout, you know, meals, whether or not to hydrate with water or electrolytes, you know, during a workout, whether or not that's different if you're weightlifting or if you're doing endurance training. You'll see a lot of recommendations that are based on performance. But what I'm going to share now is actually recommendations that are purely based on maintaining gut barrier integrity. So if you're doing anything that's really intense for your body through a variety of mechanisms, that's going to cause a leaky gut. And so you want to minimize that as much as possible. So what research shows is having an empty stomach when you workout is very, very helpful. So recommendations are to not eat for at least 30 minutes before the beginning of training or the beginning of a competition. And that depending on the intensity of activity, that leaky gut can persist for about 2 hours afterwards. And so then purely from this leaky gut perspective, not from a performance perspective, the recommendations are to avoid eating for approximately 2 hours after you're done working out. Now, it's also super important to eat enough food throughout the day to support recovery and repair when you're not training. So it's actually a really important concept in this is to make sure that your meals are not close to when you're doing this intense activity, but when you do eat, it's really nutrient dense, it's very, very balanced, and it's sufficient nutrients and energy. So you're just eating enough to really fuel everything that you're doing. So what's really interesting, while other research is showing that from a hydration perspective, it might be better to go to pure water when working out, from a gut barrier health perspective, the gut barrier was most protected when athletes consumed about 16 ounces per hour. So that's, you know, two cups per hour of a beverage that was under 10% carbohydrate. So a lot of sports beverages are more like 30% carbohydrate, so diluted, that included both glucose and a little bit of fructose. So fructose actually helps the glucose get into your muscles faster when you're in an active state, and electrolytes. And that combination is actually ideal for maintaining gut barrier integrity. So avoid food, and avoid anything that's going to require digestion, but simple glucose and fructose and some electrolytes, if relatively diluted in water, was sort of the best option from a gut barrier perspective during intense training. And then three more aspects to this. One is to avoid training in hot weather. So when it's hot outside, that exaggerates the effect to the gut barrier. So it's better, you know, if it's summer, you live somewhere where the weather's hot, see if you can get that intense training done early in the morning, late in the evening once it starts to cool off, or keep it indoors. And especially helpful if you're somebody who's had issues with, autoimmune disease, chronic illness, things that go along with a leaky gut. And then research also shows that taking a probiotic supplement and actually taking it in a relatively short, an hour before the start of exercise can be very, very helpful for maintaining gut barrier integrity. And from what we understand about how probiotic bacteria influence how the gut barrier is working, that makes a lot of sense. And those studies were done in Lactobacillus and Bifidobacterium strains of bacteria. So your classic, the type of supplement that you can get anywhere, the type of strains that are in sauerkraut. So something like sauerkraut juice that doesn't have, pieces in it that you have to digest might be a good option here in terms of getting those probiotics and getting a bigger diversity while also avoiding eating before you do your intense activity. And then the last really important aspect about this is to make sure that you're getting sufficient rest. So stress and lack of sleep also magnify this effect. So not being a stressed out person, and I think a lot of us work out as a stress management tool, so that benefits us. But really working to increase your resilience to stress, which means doing things like meditating and going for walks and, laughing. Laughing's great. But doing those types of activities, reducing stressors where you have the ability to, and making sure you're getting ample sleep is really, really critical. And then making sure that when you're doing these intense workouts that you have enough recovery time between your workouts. So the research says at least 24 hours. A lot of us, it's 23 hours, right? So we have to think about that. That if we go to the same fitness class that's an hour long, the same CrossFit class that's an hour long every day, that's not actually hitting 24 hours of recovery time. And so that means being really careful with that, and also having days off, having recovery days where we're just sticking with light movement, having rest days where we're actually relatively sedentary. and you throw those in once in a while, they're extremely beneficial. And so all of those things, you know, some of those things are going to help performance, like fueling your activity well enough and taking adequate recovery time. But all of those recommendations come purely from a gut function perspective. And when you approach activity with that perspective, it's different than, you know, trying to achieve some kind of, you know, new, you know, personal record in the gym, or, you know, training for a race that's coming up. It's a long-term perspective, right? It's how do I increase my fitness level? How do I become a stronger and more agile person and enjoy all of the health benefits that go with that without, you know, undermining my health in other ways? So how do I get all the best of an active lifestyle without the problems? And we know that there's problems because when we look at elite athletes, they have much higher rates of a bunch of different immune-related conditions. So they are more susceptible to certain kinds of infections. Autoimmune disease rates are higher. Even some cancer rates can be higher. And that all boils down to a dysfunctional immune system. So as the average user, that doesn't mean that if we, you know, work out and we like to run in the mornings, that that's going to automatically give us cancer. But when we see this in the, you know, the people who are exercising at a really intense level for large periods of time during the day, it helps us understand the mechanisms of how it's impacting their bodies. And then ours is like the pared down version of that. So we can take that information and figure out how to implement that in our daily lives in a way that, you know, we get the benefits of exercise without any potential downsides.
So I will just say, from a practical implementation standpoint, you know, I focused on doing as much as I could to heal my gut before taking on intense exercise. And, you know, now I'm at a place where I focus on things that benefit performance versus only considering gut health. So I think it's important for people, like you were saying, not all of these are going to optimize performance in considering where their goals are and what their priorities are. And I know for me, all of these would have been really important a couple of years ago. And then once, you know, I did the paleo approach and AIP and resolved a lot of issues that I was having, now I feel comfortable knowing that, you know, during intense exercise, because I train for 3 to 4 hours one day a week, there is more than just water or 10% less than carbohydrate being consumed, right? Like I often eat an RX bar, which has significant carbohydrate, or I drink a green juice, which has significant carbohydrate. But I do that because it's a healthier version of alternative foods that are made for that kind of performance. And also because it does boost my energy levels to continue training for a longer period of time. So I think it just really, you know, people need to figure out how they can optimize these things and what their goals are. And I think some of your ideas, like, you know, don't train in hot weather. Well, people aren't going to take the entire summer off. So, you know, doing it in the morning or doing it at night or doing it inside, I think are good ways to kind of practically implement some of these things so that it's a little more reasonable.
Yeah, so I think that, I mean, every person needs to figure out what their priorities are. And, you know, one of the, you know, you are implementing some pretty key aspects like rest days, right? You're not doing this for 4 hours every day. And I think that if you were doing it for 4 hours every day and eating an RX bar, you would know. I think that would get to you and you would not be seeing gains and you would not be feeling healthy. So I think that there's what's optimal for the body and there's what the body tolerates. And what we're all trying to do is live somewhere in between. So this is the recommendations based on scientific studies that have looked into this. And then we all take that information and do with it what is appropriate for us.
All right, questions? Questions and Answers, where we answer questions submitted by you through the contact form on our websites, paleomom.com and paleoparents.com.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. Your my only hope.
So Natalie says, I've just started CrossFit, totally inspired by both of you guys and your journeys. Love the idea of strongman, but not quite as accessible where I live. Anyway, so part of starting involves like a nutrition consult. As I'm already aligned with their nutrition program, the coach suggested I start working on water intake. I thought, yep, cool, that's easy. But I just recently started hearing about only drink when thirsty. Totally makes sense going with only eat when hungry. And drinking the 2 to 3 liters of water a day may not be as good as what they make out it to be. What are your thoughts and some science, please?
My thought is that dehydration is legit. So when I was training for my first strongman competition in March of last year, I was following a drink when you're thirsty philosophy, and my body does a really poor job of telling me when it's thirsty and a really hyperbolic job of telling me when it's hungry. So I've also learned that sometimes I can't trust my body, but ultimately at that time, I wasn't drinking as much as I really should have been, even though I don't like that word. And during the contest, I got dehydrated. I also had a stomach flu, which also led to dehydration. And the result of that was clinical dehydration that led to vertigo, which I still have to occasionally take medication for a year and a half later. So I would caution against just blindly drinking like 3 liters of water a day if it doesn't feel good. I know, Sarah, you probably have some science on whether or not it actually washes away the nutrients. But I definitely think that, you know, if you're not very thirsty, you might want to consider whether or not you're getting enough water. You know, look at your overall food consumption. Things like, you know, fresh vegetables do have a lot of water content in them. So if you're eating a lot of fresh vegetables, you know, it offsets kind of the standards that people prescribe for people who are eating a lot of processed food, which doesn't have any fluid content in it. But at the same time, you know, you can't just get by with, you know, 1 8-ounce glass of water and a salad a day. Like, that's going to not be enough, especially when you start training and, or if it's hot outside or whatever the case may be.
Yeah. So there's, you know, I've seen a little bit of this idea that if you consume less water, that you get into, it's like a high temperature state. So you burn more fat or something. I have not seen any science to support that. And it's really important for people to understand that water is required for detoxification systems to work properly. So if you want your liver to do its job and if you want your kidneys to do its job, you need water. And when we're exercising, we're losing water more than when we're sedentary because we're sweating, because we're breathing more heavily and we lose, you know, about the same amount of water through exhalation and just the humidity in our breath as we do peeing every day. And so it's really important that we're like losing water, we need to replenish that. And so the recommendations of 2 to 3 liters are based on how much water we lose between evaporation and urination. And so I have not seen any valid science to support any health benefits to decreasing water intake. If anything, you know, being well hydrated has a huge number of health benefits, right? It's better for your cardiovascular system. It's better for your cellular health. And it doesn't wash away nutrients. It helps you detox.
The specifics of what I've heard weren't around like lower temperature fat burning. It was around if you drink too much water, then it can prevent nutrient absorption because it's like washing away the nutrients before your body has a chance to absorb it.
So, I mean, certainly we know that if you're drinking a lot with your meals, that it dilutes stomach acid and that can actually reduce the signals to your pancreas and your gallbladder to secrete, you know, bile acids and pancreatic enzymes into the small intestine. And so there is an idea that consuming too much liquid with meals can actually inhibit overall digestion, but that doesn't mean that, you know, overall water intake is an issue. So when you drink a lot of water, it's absorbed very, very easily. And what happens is your water will, so it's absorbed predominantly in the large intestine. Food is absorbed predominantly in the small intestine. I've never seen anything that says water intake increases transit time. I'm going to check that out right now. Water intake, gut transit time. Yay for PubMed. And oh, a really good example of this would be to look at can't see anything. Ooh, that's water going up the wrong hole.
And now we've sufficiently talked about poop. Transit time, it was veiled and I was comfortable with it. And then you just had to break the barrier of things Stacey doesn't need to envision.
You know, as we talked about last week, it's my favorite thing.
Pooping?
Well, yes, it's always enjoyable. Oh my God. Talking about it and making you feel uncomfortable.
That's true. Good job. You win.
So PubMed's not turning up anything. I mean, this might be one of those things that if I search for 3 hours with 300 different search terms, I'll find the one obscure journal that says something that was tested in 3 people and is like really like not rigorously done. But you know, everything that I'm seeing is talking about increasing water intake, not decreasing it. So I think that's one of those, like, somebody drinks a lot of water and notices that it changes their stool quality and then they think that they're losing nutrients. I think it's probably one of those not at all based in science things. I will look it up more, and if I have an update, I will give an update during the podcast next week. But I think people should drink water. That's what I'm saying.
I think people should drink water too.
I use the should word, but
I just, you know. I caution people about feeling uncomfortable with water consumption, because when I drink, like, some strong men, and I'm sure some CrossFitters just carry around like a gallon of water all day and drink multiple of those a day. Like I physically can't do that. It makes me sick. And so I do think there's something to be said for listening to your body a little bit. So if you're drinking like a lot of water and you don't feel good, you know, use common sense.
I naturally, so I don't have any goals set for my liquid intake. But when I track it, I'm naturally drinking a few gallons a day. And I always have, like always. And that's just, I basically drink constantly throughout the day. Water. I'd be a lot more fun if I drank something else during constantly throughout the day. I'm just saying. But I think that there's a lot in listening to your signals, but we see this a lot in the paleo community of people under drinking when they cut way back on their salt intake. So the paleo diet does not necessarily restrict salt, but as soon as you cut out processed and refined foods, you're cutting out a lot of high salt foods. So it's naturally a lower sodium diet. And as you had the experience of, you know, reducing sodium and then naturally not drinking as much and then compounding that with a stomach bug, that's a really common thing that happens in the paleo community. So I think I feel uncomfortable with the idea of people, you know, without a diagnosed condition that might indicate that. I don't even know what that condition would be, but without a doctor saying we got to reduce your fluid intake, I feel really uncomfortable with people deliberately trying to ignore thirst signals and reduce their liquid intake. I feel like that's not going to do anything good.
I think we've sufficiently answered the question without actually giving an answer at all.
I think we did.
Natalie. She doesn't know what to do. She's just going to drink some stuff.
I think drinking is good. I don't think she should reduce her fluid intake is what I'm saying. I think that answered her question. Natalie, if you didn't answer your question, email us again. All right. Our next question is from Melissa. On the podcast before, you talked about how too much exercise could be bad for you. How can an individual know how much is too much? What do you think of training at a specific heart rate and slower pace? I am an endurance athlete, age grouper, not pro. I've come to love running and triathlon, and I'm training for a marathon. My health has improved so much in the last 3 years, and I think running has helped with that. Of course, my diet has improved too. I lost 30 pounds, my blood pressure is down, and I can run faster and farther than ever before. In addition to just feeling way better, I wasn't a couch potato before, but couldn't run to the end of the block either. Today, for example, I did an easy run of 6 miles in an hour, 10-minute mile. I was not tired and barely broke a sweat listening to your podcast on the way. I don't run every day and have lots of rest days. I'm guessing you'll say the marathon is too much. What do you think of the much shorter runs, 6 to 10-ish miles? Did the studies you found also look at the diet of runners? I know people who use running as an excuse to eat junk, and lots of events have pasta dinners, which would only make me run to the porta potty. Thanks for your recommendations.
Okay, Melissa, Sarah and I aren't runners. There are plenty of people who are runners who are healthy. I think I've come to this place in my life where, I'm becoming like this old woman who just throws up my hand and I'm like, whatever. I'm going to say that here. I know people, in my life who are runners, and one of them is incredibly healthy and doesn't have any physical ailments, loves to run, it makes them feel good, and they don't have any other health conditions that would cause me to be concerned. I know two other people who have a lot of physical ailments on a regular basis, and they run frequently. They have joint pain or back problems or some physical ailments that are related to their probably immune system. In those people, I would say could consider cutting back running and seeing how their body responds instead of constantly being in this yo-yo cycle of, I have to not run because I don't feel well. I'm going to let my body recover. And as soon as I recover, I'm going to start running heavy again. And then as soon as I run heavy again, I get injured and I have to pull back. Right. And it's the same thing with CrossFit. It's the same thing with people who, you know, weightlift, right? Like there are just some people who either aren't, you know, stretching and mobilizing, using the right form, or it's maybe just not suited for their body. And then there are other people like, you know, I say this and then of course next week I'm going to get injured, but like, I don't have any problems when I lift. There are a ton of strongmen who, you know, are injured on a regular basis, and I've been doing it a long time and I don't have those problems. So I think a lot of that has to do with like, I focus on mobility and stretching and I take my time between lifts, and I only lift 3 or 4 days a week instead of, you know, 5 or 6 days a week. So I think it's the same concept with running. Like, how do you feel? You say that you feel fine. I mean, personally, I think breaking a sweat is a good idea, and I think getting your heart rate up is a good idea, but it's a matter of, like, how are you recovering and how are you feeling after? And, you know, if you have health problems that you can't resolve, it's one of the things that could be irritating your system to look at as a stressor to eliminate. And that, again, goes across, you know, multiple platforms, not just for running. I mean, we've harped on running before just because we see a lot of people kind of addicted to it and doing it, even though it might not be the best thing for their health, but it really goes across anything that is a problem. That's what I got.
Yeah, I think, you know, I've been asked this question so many times, and I think I already alluded to this earlier in the podcast, but it's really hard to quantify what is too much for one person. And some people are just really built for running. Like, some people, that is the activity that their bodies are meant to do. And so I'm not anti-running. I have actually run 2 marathons myself. I don't know if you knew that about me. Did you know that about me?
Yeah, but you had all kinds of problems after.
But they wrecked me.
Yeah.
And it was my major, I mean, the major health crisis that, you know, basically colored my next decade was after my second marathon and while I was training for my third. And so for me, it was far too much stress for my body, especially given that I, you know, I was doing all of the junk that runners do, right? The carb loading and the, you know, squeezable sugar things during runs and, that are, you know, full of chemicals and whatever. So, you know, my diet was not particularly great at the time. I mean, it wasn't as bad as it then got when I got completely defeatist, when I got completely unhealthy and just decided to binge eat everything. That's a whole other story. So, you know, I think that if Melissa's really feeling great and this is her passion and this is something that's helping her manage her stress, you know, I just would urge her to be really critical in evaluating how it's impacting her. And things to look for are things that you've already mentioned. So things like joint pain, things like, you know, injuries, right? So like with runners, that might be something like, you know, really sore IT bands or, you know, problems with Achilles tendons, foot tendons, bone spurs, shin splints, right? These types of things are some of the things that are definitely a sign of wear and tear on your body. Hip pain, really exaggerated muscle pain, especially after long training runs. Trouble sleeping, so not sleeping well, not waking up feeling energized, needing coffee to get going in the morning, feeling grumpy, being moody, mood swings, headaches, any kind of skin problems, any kind of chronic illness. These are all things that are indicative of a stress on the body. And stress can be psychological and it can be physical. And that's where this level of training really comes in, right? It can be as much strain on the body as severe psychological stress. It isn't for everybody. And I know for me, right, I started CrossFit when I had adrenal fatigue, which is not what the typical recommendation is for people, right? Typically, when you have adrenal fatigue, it's recommended that you sleep all the time and that you don't do any intense exercise. But it was actually critical for my recovery because it was so important for my stress management. And so I understand this, you know, finding this balance between a more intense activity because of the stress management and then what is actually a good level physically for our bodies. So I would look at those types of things. I think that, you know, if she's a really elite athlete, her heart rate's not going to be going really high when she's training. And definitely I think that the heart rate ranges have some pretty good science behind them. So, I mean, that's the whole like Orange Theory type idea, right? Is to keep your heart rate in that medium range, never go into red, but be above green. I think that's the idea. Not the idea of Orange Theory. So I think that makes a lot of sense to me from an endurance, I mean, just an endurance training perspective, right? If you're doing something that's really intense heart rate, that's not sustainable. That's a stress on the body. So making sure that heart rate's not going too high is definitely something that makes sense for a prolonged activity. And then the studies that looked at, to answer a question directly, the studies that looked at leaky gut and athletes were done in runners, cyclists, and triathletes. Those are the three groups of athletes that all of these too much exercise studies are generally done in. There's a handful of studies done in bodybuilders. They're almost all done in distance runners, triathletes, and distance cyclists. And it's because of that very long, you know, duration of high cardio, right, type activity, and that the strain that has on the body is much more intense than the strain from weightlifting. The only thing that's sort of similar that's a weightlifting activity would be high intensity interval training. So if you're doing something like strongman where you're lifting weights and you're taking a rest period between sets, that is not the same strain on your body as this type of endurance training. And so it makes it, I think, a little bit trickier for people who really love this type of endurance training to strike that balance, because it is something that is inherently more strenuous for the body and more stress on the body. So I would just encourage Melissa to really be aware of those little signals that her body is giving her so that she can pare back where she needs to pare back, whether that means running a half marathon instead of a full, whether that means taking an extra rest day, you know, however feels, you know, makes her feel like she's recovered by the next time she's doing a run, and just really being proactive about monitoring for those things rather than waiting until it's impacted her health negatively and she has to spend years recovering and ends up, you know, where I was in my mid-20s after running marathons.
Yeah, I think that the other part of her question was, did the studies that you look at also look at the diet of the runners? Oh, yeah. And I think we've covered a lot of that this podcast, but just to also consider, I know people who do long runs are often eating in between, much like I am with weightlifting, right? If you're running for hours, kind of training for a marathon, people have asked us a lot, like, what could I take with me instead of those junk food? And we can tell you things like RX bars and whatever. But again, if your health isn't good and your gut health isn't good, you're just aggravating that by eating during that time period. So regardless of what the studies are finding, you know, Sarah's already covered the science on the diet of the stuff. So just something to consider.
Yeah. And I guess the more direct answer to her question is, those studies are not separating cyclists into group by how they eat, but they're looking at professional athletes. So it's generally a group of people who, I mean, it's not paleo, it's not grain-free or gluten-free, but they're generally people who are very aware of protein intake. They generally, you know, do, right, it would be like clean eating. So it's generally, to totally throw a stereotype onto professional endurance athletes, but they're generally people who eat to fuel their activities. So they might be pasta, but at least it's a sauce that's made with high quality ingredients. It's a long ways away from paleo, and there's not the pool of people to look at for these studies where you can start saying, okay, so who's following a Mediterranean diet and who's following a paleo diet and who's following a, you know, gluten-free diet, and who's, you know, a ketogenic diet, and who, right? Like all of these, you could start separating it out into 20, 30 different diets. Who's low carb, who's high fat, like, and there just isn't, those studies are incredibly difficult to do in people at the best of times. And when you start saying you also have to be a professional athlete, then it's basically means that you can't find enough study participants to actually have good statistics for your studies. So until there's way more of us eating paleo, we're not going to be able to do a study like that, I'm afraid.
All right. Go on your walk. Go do things with the people that you like.
You make it sound like I don't like you.
Well, I mean, sometimes you're like, I would rather be taking a nap. You know,
I may or may not have texted that the longer we podcast, it was the longer before I had to wait before I could have a margarita. I may have said that.
Yeah. So it's not like I'm feeling the love over here.
Aww. Well, I will talk to you next week with another amazing podcast for everybody. And I will, you know, obviously be reading some more about transit times and see if I can hone in on whether or not there is any science.
Also, you're going to Google Tovlo.
clearly.
Because you have not enough stuff to do in your life, and this is definitely an endeavor that when you're laying on your deathbed, you're going to be like, wow, I'm really glad I looked up that girl's lyrics. But so, you told me earlier in the show that laughter was good for you, so I'm telling you, you will enjoy it.
All right. It's done. It's actually in the Google search engine.
There you go.
As I speak. So I will enjoy that greatly. I'm hoping it doesn't just start singing at me while we're Skyping.
All right, everyone, have a great week. Don't forget, if you're enjoying the show, to leave us a review, however you're listening to this, so that other listeners can find us. And we will be back next week, because that's a thing, 151 episodes. It's a...
And never missing a week.
It's a thing, even when people are on the West Coast and people are doing all kinds of crazy stuff. We're figuring it out. So we'll be back next week.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Thank you for listening to The Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.
Yeah, I was going to say what I was going to say on the show, but clearly you're, like, not doing the show, so.
Oh, are you being on the show?
I was going to be on the show.
Oh.
Ugh, you are in vacation mode.
All right. I am going to go get drunk, and I will talk to you next week.